Florida's unemployment system and its problems. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thousands of Floridians lost hours and hours trying to get through the state to sign up for unemployment benefits. That's back when the pandemic started. Well, it turns out many of them were declined for the smallest reasons, and we'll find out why. Also, prejudice and violence against Asians is not new, though it has dominated the headlines recently. It's a problem that's been a part of the American story for more than a century. We'll tell you about a program coming to FIU that will tackle some of that history. And finally, South Florida's obsession with mangoes.
You don't get these with another fruit.
It's time to tickle the taste buds with a story about mango season. The program is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. When the pandemic hit, Florida's unemployment system was overwhelmed with applications for benefits. The system, called Connect, already had a lot of problems, but many people were denied their benefits because of the efforts to try and cut down fraud. And it was that effort that left so many without help. Well, joining us now is Lawrence Maurer. He's a reporter for the Tampa Bay Times and the Miami Herald at the Tallahassee Bureau. Lawrence, always great to have you.
Hey, Luis, thanks for having me on.
So let me get this right. From the start of the pandemic, you know, we saw and we heard from hundreds of people down here in South Florida that they had a lot of trouble applying for benefits through the Florida system. It was just this terrible experience. But we have to start with the fact that this all goes back to the last administration under Governor Scott. What did he do that created a system that was so tough to get through in the first place?
Well, Rick Scott did a few things. He made it harder to actually qualify for benefits by imposing like strict work search requirements and actually limiting the number of weeks you could get benefits. He also rolled out a new unemployment website known as Connect, which, as you noted, was a disaster from the very start, and he never fixed it. And he also rolled out a new anti-fraud system within Connect, which seems to have been gamed to kick people out.
You know, so there are two issues here, really, that occurred. One, again, as you pointed out, Connect, that unemployment computer system, just it had a lot of problems. And there were audits that brought up those issues to the DeSantis administration. But then there was, the effort to protect against fraud. When did you start hearing from people who were hired by the state to take those calls about what was happening?
Well, we've heard various things from call takers from the very start, you know, about missing applications and all kinds of crazy stuff. But this issue about the efforts to prevent fraud, I heard relatively recently. And what these call center workers said is that, you know, when these are the people that when you needed to get help on your unemployment application last year or even now, you call into these call centers. And you wait on hold often for 8 hours or more sometimes and talk to one of these call takers. And what these call takers told me is that, you know, they couldn't actually help people. And what they were told to do by the Department of Economic Opportunity, which runs the unemployment system, is that they were supposed to, if they heard any issue that would make someone unable or unavailable to work, to flag those people. So for example, often you'd be talking to these people for hours on the phone. You know, you would share your life story sometimes, you know, with these call center workers. Say you said you were pregnant. Those people were required to flag you as being unable to work.
You know, one of the other things that you pointed out in the story I thought was, mind blowing is that if you're like, for example, you have one of these callers and they were talking to someone, and if any piece of information that caller told them didn't match the information on the application, it could be something really tiny, then they would have to just hang up and end the call, right?
That's right. So there's a couple things going on here. One is that, you know, fraud in the unemployment system in the last year across the country has been a big deal, right? I mean, there's been there's a federal report that flagged there were billions of dollars in fraud that's gone out. And, you know, and states were really struggling to kind of balance this need to get unemployment benefits out to people while also trying to limit fraud. But the way the system was set up, this anti-fraud system, is that, you know, say, Lewis, you didn't include your middle initial on your application because you were just doing it in a hurry and just got it up as quickly as you could. Well, when you talked to that call center worker about your application and you did not recite everything exactly the way it showed up, say, for example, you put apartment number on your application but said unit number, you were flagged for fraud and they were required to hang up on you without telling you why. So you'd have to call them back. I mean, a lot of people went through this. A lot of people experienced this.
And as you said, yeah, fraud is a real thing. Federal officials, you know, put the spotlight on South Florida. Sadly, we are the nation's number one fraud capital. But what did the DeSantis administration say, you know, about the complaints that were coming in? You know, again, of people being stuck on the system and then being just thrown off for the smallest of things?
Not a whole lot. They say that they take fraud seriously, and that's been their MO, basically. This was a deliberate decision by the DeSantis administration. There was a push-pull within the government about, hey, should we just get these just pay people? We'll go after the fraudsters later. We'll try to get the money back from the fraudsters later. DeSantis has said that, no, he thought that was a ridiculous idea. Let's limit fraud. Let's not pay people out right away. Let's try to, pick out the fraud. And what happened was that a lot of people saw their claims locked. If you were flagged for fraud for any reason, you had your claim locked, which, of course, that once your claim was locked, as a lot of listeners know, you had to talk to a special adjudicator to get this resolved.
Yep.
It was a total nightmare because there weren't that many adjudicators. And so, I mean, if you were flagged for fraud for any reason, your claim was going to be pushed back by an order of weeks, if not months.
Again, talking with reporter Lawrence Maurer, the Tallahassee correspondent for the Tampa Bay Times and Miami Herald. We'll share some of his recent work on this issue on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Check it out there. Again, looking at some of the challenges that people experienced while they were filing for benefits and the state's efforts to try to avoid fraud, but how that left a lot of people basically waiting weeks and weeks, if not months, for those benefits. So, Lawrence, I mean, it seems like Floridians didn't really have much of a recourse. If they were on that call, they were waiting for hours, they got disconnected, they were put on that list. I mean, they were really, the easiest way to say it, they were screwed.
Oh, yeah. No, they were definitely screwed. And, the system was never set up to really get people's benefits out in the first place. Like when there's been a lot of talk, including from DeSantis, about, was this system designed to fail? And, well, yeah, this is one of the ways it was designed to fail. You know, when this anti-fraud system was rolled out in 2014, the Scott administration said that this was a state-of-the-art system. It was a national model for anti-fraud efforts. And, it doesn't appear that it was actually catching fraud. It looks like it was catching a lot of just legitimate applications. The way the software system worked is that if you, it would match up databases. Okay, so like through LexisNexis and through other state government databases, your driver's license. If your application didn't exactly match, to the T, every single item on your application, about your personal details, work history, whatnot, it would automatically flag you as fraudulent. And when we saw the effects of this, when this system rolled out in 2014, the year after that, they say that the state said that the number of fraudulent claims they caught went up nearly 600%, which defies logic, really. Right. I mean, there's just not that much fraud out there with this. Florida, we saw the effects of it right after as well, which the percentage of unemployed people in Florida who could get unemployment benefits, it dropped the lowest in the country the year after this anti-fraud system rolled out. So was it really catching fraud? It probably caught some cases of fraud, but a lot of these things, during the pandemic, here's one thing that caught a lot of people. If you and your wife filed for unemployment benefits from the same computer, which has the same computer IP address, you would be flagged as fraudulent. And so, you know, a lot of these things kind of defied logic during the pandemic. And we do know that they took down some of the system, at least temporarily, because it was just creating a huge nightmare for the state. So it does appear that it was taken down briefly, but it was brought back up. And we don't really know the extent of that. Lawmakers have not explored this. And then there's the other aspect of this, which is just policies. You know, the DeSantis administration had a choice here. They could have, you know, removed the strict anti-fraud system. And they also could have said, opened up availability to people. So when you mentioned the pregnant women and people with childcare, the people like were caring for children at home, like everyone was when schools were closed last year, you did not qualify for benefits, for state benefits.
Right.
Because you were not able and available to work under state law. Well, that is something that DeSantis could have dropped. He could have removed that, like that requirement, like Texas did, but he chose not to. And it's a big question why.
And I mean, look, the economy is getting better, but there's still a lot of people out there who, you know, trying to pay the rent, who need their benefits. I mean, has it gotten any better? There are fewer calls than before, but does that mean those people who are trying to call in now, is the system working a little bit easier for them?
Well, it's still a mess. And, you know, the department has recognized that it's still a mess. Connect is still taking down every night to process applications. That's kind of how the system was designed. But also that, like, one of the latest anti-fraud things they did was kind of it looks like they've been cross matching a database of incarceration. So if you were arrested even for a day in jail years ago, for some reason that's been catching people and flagging their claims as fraudulent, basically because those people would technically not be available to work now. But something has clearly gone wrong, and that's been a recurring issue just within the last month or so.
Is there any effort right now, the legislative session, to address this?
Not so far. There's a bill that's being heard today that would raise the unemployment benefits to $375 a week. That'd be the maximum. That's up from $275 a week, which, of course, as we all learned last year, was just pathetically low and not enough to live on, certainly in Florida. That's being heard today in the Senate. You know, there's no such proposal that's been heard in the House. There's been some amendments to that bill today that would remove these requirements that you must be able and available to work if you're pregnant or whatnot. That would be something that will be heard today. But frankly, there's been virtually no action on unemployment this session, and there's been no real exploration of why the system failed last year.
And again, you paint the picture of just why so many people, we heard from so many people last year who were having a hard time just getting through on the phone. And well, there you go. That's why. Again, talking with reporter Lawrence Maurer, Tampa Bay Times, Miami Herald, Tallahassee Bureau. Check out his reporting on this story at WLRN Sundial. Lawrence, thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
All right. Still to come, a conversation about anti-Asian hate, its role in history, and the efforts to stop it. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Violent incidents against Asians and Asian Americans have more than doubled during the pandemic. Researchers at California State University found an increase of 150% when it came to anti-Asian hate. It's added to the larger discussion about racism and discrimination in our society. Now, those conversations became more difficult and pressing after the shootings that happened in Atlanta earlier this month, which resulted in the deaths of 8 people, 6 of whom were Asian women. By the way, Florida International University is hosting a teach-in on this topic tomorrow. Find out how you could join on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Joining us now is Mitzi Carter, a professor of anthropology and interim director of the Global Indigenous Forum at FIU. She'll be part of that teach-in tomorrow. Mitzi, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Lewis.
You know, in your bio, you mentioned that being Black and Okinawan has shaped your research interests. How so?
Yes. I have grown up with two different stories about Okinawa as a space, which is where my mother is from. And I always kind of had questions about how they came to these, to the same space with these very different ideas about you know, what it means to be Okinawan, what it means to be Asian. And I have always kind of questioned race just because of, you know, hearing all of these multiple competing stories. And so I went into anthropology to kind of give me the tools to understand and question what that means, what it means to be racialized, what it means to grow up with two different ethnicities in the same household, what it means to grow up in the US South and to think about immigration and what it means for women who are coming from, you know, these Asian countries to a place like the US South.
You know, I mean, for you, growing up with, you know, having two stories, really, you know, having your mother while she was growing up in Okinawa and her experience, and of course, your experience, you know, here in the United States. What was that like growing up? What were those conversations like at the dinner table at home?
You know, they were pretty mundane for the most part. You know, the times when they were really, I think, more significant or when they stood out more was like, for example, when we had an incident at a pool. And I grew up in Houston. And then right outside the outskirts of Houston, there was a place called Jacinto City. And my sister and I went to a swimming pool. And we were called the N-word by a group of children, with their parents just kind of looking over them. And when we came back, my mother was the one who, you know, talked to us about what that meant. And she actually, in order to kind of help us through that, she used her own experiences of being stigmatized as an Okinawan person in Japan. And you know, we grew up hearing about racism from my father also, but in a different kind of way. It was less direct in that kind of, in those kind of storytelling events. They were more like, you know, he would complain about not being promoted or training someone who was a younger white person and then, you know, still kind of staying at the same place. And so we heard very different versions of racism. And I think that's what kind of helped it was really a mix of different stories.
Yeah. But I mean, you as an African American woman, I mean, did unless somebody knew you, they didn't know about your Okinawan background, though.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they wouldn't know for the most part. I mean, growing up, we grew up in a very black neighborhood in Houston. And so, you know, people knew us locally on our street. You know, we for Kodomo no Hi, like it's a Children's Day event, we would have my mother would get this big pole with the koi flapping at the top of it, you know.
Yeah.
And, you know, the kids would come by and be like, what is that? So we'd have to explain what that meant. And it's in those kinds of instances, I think, that I started to think about myself a little bit differently. The kind of worldviews that shaped me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Is there a parallel between like black families and Asian families not talking a lot about that difficult part of the history, trying to maybe avoid it?
I know for Asian people, there tends to be some conversation about it. And it's just, you know, the Asian ethnic group is very large and diverse. But I think there is a tendency to not talk about it outside the home, you know, because certainly my mother did talk a lot about what it meant to be Okinawan in contrast to, you know, Japanese mainlander, because there's a history of discrimination for Okinawans. And so when it comes to pointing out, like to airing out those kinds of issues that people feel, people who are being targeted violently, for example, that is still, people don't like to report that. That's why we see a lot of underreporting of violent crimes against Asians today. There's an effort to try to get people to talk about it more, but it has historically been seen as kind of embarrassing. And then, you know, I think for African Americans, we have more ways to articulate the kind of racist attacks that have happened to us. So again, I think that happens also within our own communities. There's a language that is that we can latch onto to talk about that and make sense of it, but it's still painful. You know, I think for a lot of people of my father's generation, didn't like to talk about a lot of the things that happened. I found out about a white mob attacking my grandfather when I was, you know, late in my 30s. I didn't know that that happened to him. So there's a lot of trauma that people carry intergenerationally. And it's, I think we're finally coming to a point where people are finding ways to address that.
Mm. You know, at this teach-in, you're going to be reading a personal essay, I believe. It's called Nappy Roots and Tangled Tales, A Personal Reflection on Anti-Asian Violence and White Supremacy. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, it's Nappy Roots as in R-O-U-T-E-S.
Right.
And I wanted to share a story about my mother's journey from Okinawa to the U.S. South. And it's actually also a journey of being kind of racialized in multiple ways, and how she learned about anti-Blackness, and how my father learned about anti-Asianness to some degree. She didn't use the term Asian until many years later, after living in the U.S. And she wouldn't even tell people she was Japanese. She was definitively Okinawan. So Asianness was something very new for her in the U.S. context. And I think she realized that no one had any idea where Okinawa was or what it meant until, you know, Karate Kid came along, maybe. No one certainly didn't know that Okinawa is a culturally distinct place, or that it was an independent kingdom, or that they had their own languages and cultural practices. So for her to say, you know, tell something like she was Japanese, it was very difficult. But she would eventually start saying that. And my reflection piece kind of speaks to the ways that identity is dynamic. And it also deals with the intersections with anti-Asian violence and misogynist ideas that are embedded in ideas around Orientalism and what it means to be, you know, how the idea of Orientalism was shaped throughout history and how that matters today.
You know, so, the things that she faced, that your mother faced, is it still the same now? Those same issues, the way white America looks at someone like her, are they still saying the same things, still thinking the same things?
Yeah, I think so. I think they get circulated and they come up in these kinds of times when you have, you know, they're flamed by people who are using this kind of this cold, I think in times of like these Cold War rhetoric where politicians with demagogue-like tendencies are yelling out things like China flu or Kung flu or whatever despicable things that people are repeating, you know, that they're placing these old stereotypes, and they may go away for a little while, but they're still finding these narratives to return and bring them back in our contemporary time. And that's what's dangerous, is we have to see the way that these things repeat, that they're cyclical. So she doesn't get that all the time, but, you know, I worry. For example, I call her every day and I tell her, you know, be vigilant, be careful. I'm so scared someone's going to spit on her or trip her or punch her or say something nasty. And so I think, you know, it's right now, and she doesn't get that all the time. There are waves of it, and we see this upsurge right now.
I wonder, does she feel that way about you? You know, she worry about you.
That's interesting. I mean, because I don't present as Asian to many people, maybe not so much, but I know she does worry about that when I'm in certain spaces when, you know, there's, you know, for example, last summer, she was very worried. She didn't want me to go to protests.
Yeah.
So I think it goes both ways, which also speaks to the issue of solidarity. There's a lot of understanding, you know, when, for example, the police mentioned on the news that this killer, this murderer of these women in Atlanta was just having a bad day, that this was a racially motivated attack. I think a lot of people in the Black community kind of did a double take. They were like, wait, no. We know what this is like. You know, we understand what's going on here. This kind of sympathetic look at somebody who is really deeply racially motivated to attack, you know, these women. That comes from the seed of Orientalism. There's a disproportionate number of reported crimes against Asians, especially towards elderly, and also women. And yeah, I think a lot of folks in the Black community kind of see that and are organizing in solidarity with Asians. to kind of deal with what's really at root, which is white supremacy.
Again, I'm talking with Mitzi Carter. She's a professor of anthropology and interim director of the Global Indigenous Forum at FIU. We're talking about anti-Asian racism in the United States, its history, and what's being done about it. Dr. Carter, by the way, is participating in a teach-in panel on this topic tomorrow at FIU. She'll be joined by others, including comedian and advocate Margaret Cho. And you can find more information about this event on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Again, that is starting tomorrow. You know, I think about what I learned in history, you know, about the anti-Asian sentiment that's existed in this country goes back, you know, when this country, you know, out west, when we were settling out west in California, mm-hmm. Nevada, and you had a lot of people from China here who by the way, played a big role in building the railroad system, you know, in this country. And then, of course, the anti-Japanese sentiment during World War II. As you said, it seems like it there's an ebb and flow. It seems to come back in to the mainstream and then it wanes away, but it's still always there. And it kind of just seemed to pop itself back up when we saw the Atlanta shootings. It's back and it goes back to when this pandemic started.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if it's funny because I teach in Asian studies as well, and when I go over some of this material, students have very little information about this kind of the history of anti-Asian violence, especially in the 1800s. I mean, we see, I think in 1875, I believe it was, that we had the enactment, the Page Act was instituted, which was super targeted specific discrimination against East Asian women, which banned women from immigrating into the US. And it was based on this really misogynist idea rooted in Orientalist thinking. They basically believe that, you know, these are women were immigrating, were prostitutes. And then in we have in 1882, the U.S. Chinese Exclusion Act, which was really about the management of labor. And so you have these uses of this Orientalist kind of gendered stereotypes activated in multiple ways. It's these laws were justified by racist thinking that relied on these perceptions that were, of course, false, but of Chinese men as being physically weak, as economically invasive, or culturally barbaric. And so they suspended the immigration of all Chinese laborers for 10 years and required every Chinese person who was entering the country to carry paperwork. And it was the first law in the US to really broadly restrict immigration based on national origin. And it lasted really, a lot of folks don't realize that it lasted until almost 1942, just before World War II, when China became an ally. And then we see this, of course, like you mentioned, with Japanese internment, the kind of rhetoric that was used about, you know, people's loyalty or the potential to be real citizens or totally belong in the country, that you know, many Asian Americans worked so hard to build. And I mean, you can even see this, like Paul Spicker, who's a historian at UC Santa Barbara, has written about how the US even made choices about how, you know, who the mixed race Japanese people who would be released from internment camps based on very patriarchal lines. So if you had a white father, they would release you assuming that the father had more loyalty to the United States and would teach the child to be a proper citizen. But if you had a Japanese dad, then you were kept in internment. So here we can even see how gender informs ideas about how one can belong. Yeah.
I got to tell you, when I talk about that, you know, that remembering that from history, that was not in the basic curriculum. I mean, that's talking now when I was in college and going deeper into history. That's the only time you'd see it. Something too that didn't pop up much, and I'm wondering your thoughts on this, is this term, and I didn't hear it until much later in life, token minority. What does it mean when you hear Asians or Asian Americans called the token minority?
Yeah.
And where did that come from?
That's a bizarre history of that whole model minority myth. It's a funny thing, because if you look at 1800s, you have Asians being categorized as unassimilable, right? As dirty, as heathens. And you can go back to even court cases that actually go through the labor of saying Asians are absolutely definitively not white, right? Like the Takao Ozawa case in the early 1900s. But then by the mid 60s, something shifts where Asians are seen as absolutely not white to absolutely not black. But even before that, in the 40s, there's a shift where there's a push you know, to kind of get people to assimilate. You know, this is the way that you can assimilate and become proper citizens back into the fold of the country. And what happens is in the 60s is that you've got the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act, and Black folks in the U.S. are really pushing for strong systemic changes. I mean, to really root out racism, like a massive overhaul, not just Band-Aid fixes. And so there were a lot of people who were scared, who benefited from the status quo. And so, you know, they basically used Chinese and Japanese in particular as the evidence that, you know, you don't really need this kind of massive change to do better. And it was a mixture of like this, you know, social scientists to, you know, some civic organizations that were being funded by private foundations to push forward this kind of thinking. And it was awful because what it does is it places a wedge between different marginalized groups. Yeah. And so it creates this false binary of like good age, you know, good minority and bad minority. Here's the good hardworking minority, and then the minority that complains and is lazy. Instead of really addressing the what's at root, which is again the structural racism.
With little time that I have left, I wanted to touch on this, and I know it's not fair to I won't have enough time to give you on this, but I wanted your take. You know, you think that generations get better. And we'd like to think that we are getting better with each generation, the society's getting better. And yet here we are still with this issue and how we treat different groups that are not white. I mean, really, where do we begin? Is it just education or is it something else?
I think it has to be more than, I mean, of course, education is a big starting point if we can empathize and have that ability to empathize, but we have to get out of our little boxes and get out and meet people who are very different from us and humanize each other, like know our stories, understand, you know, what is causing our community's pain. And once I think you can do that, once you don't think that these stories are exceptional, you know, then I think we can really start to address solidarity based on, you know, this foundation of education, but also on love. You know, and of real understanding. People need to get out of their neighborhoods and do the work that's hard. You know,
and I think that's the best way. At least for me, I see it as get out of your neighborhood, get out of the world you see, and realize there's a much bigger world out there. But once you're in it, you start to realize a lot of that hate makes absolutely no sense at all. Mm-hmm. Mitzi Carter, professor of anthropology and interim director of the Global Indigenous Forum at FIU. Mitzi, thank you so much. I really appreciate
it. Thank you, Lewis.
And again, go to our social media, WLRN Sundial. Learn more about that teach-in that's coming up tomorrow on anti-Asian and Asian American racism. So check it out again at WLRN Sundial. By the way, stay in touch with us via text. Join the Sundial Text Club. Send us your thoughts on subjects like this or anything else. You can join the text club. Just type the word hello to 786-677-0767. Again, that's hello to 786-677-0767. Let's lighten the mood up a little bit as we go into the final segment of the program. Still to come, are those mango trees in the backyard sprouting yet? It's almost mango season. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Well, if you have allergies, your sinuses are probably not too happy right now. That's because it's mango blossom season. That means mango trees are flowering and there's going to be pollen in the air. But that's not all bad news. Your stuffy nose means there will be a robust season for the fruit. Sundial producer Leslie Ovalle spoke with Dr. Norice Ledesma. She's the president of the Florida State Horticultural Society, and she began by telling where her passion for mangoes comes from.
First of all, I'm Colombian, so I believe it's in my genes. My first memories with mangoes, if I recall, I was probably 5 years old and growing in a small village with my grandmother. So if you behave, you get a mango. We didn't have any candies in those days. So it was like the best prize to behave. You get a mango. And I believe when you talk with almost anybody that live in Miami, they have something to tell you about it. And they just roll their eyes up and they get connected with their roots and their family and all these beautiful memories. Many of us, we have memories with green mangoes, like Mexicans, for example. They also consume green mangoes. If you have the time and drive by to Homestead, they have a farmer's market during the weekends, and they sell green mangoes with all the different spices. And it's interesting because they ask you, how do you want your mangoes? So you said, well, I want chili, salt, lemon, and all the different things that you want to put on it. So it's like the best order ever.
I know I'm going to run to get a mango after this interview. I already know
they are just blooming, Leslie. So you have to wait a little longer.
Right. And so, yeah, I wanted to ask you, you know, you coming from Colombia and that being your first experience with mangoes and now doing your work here, is there a difference in mangoes there, mangoes here?
That's another good thing of this wonderful fruit. You get so connected that you believe that your mangoes are so unique. And you fight for it. When I just came from Colombia to the US, that was over 20 years ago, I was so proud of our mangoes, and I truly believe that mangoes came from Colombia. And then I have to run a mango festival for all these different years, every year in July at Fairchild, where I used to work. And all different nationalities, they came and said, what are you talking about? Mangoes are from Cuba. I remember eating mangoes from a long time ago. And everybody started, the Jamaicans start opening their eyes and said, no, I remember those beautiful mangoes in my island and the Filipino and the bizcochuelo, the Cubans claim. And the Jamaicans start talking about Julian Graham. And everybody had so much ownership for their fruit and identity with that. So it is not one thing. It is a connection with your roots. And you don't get this with another fruit. For example, bananas are the most popular fruit in the world because they are so convenient. They come in a perfect package. They are clean. You don't get messy. They are inexpensive, almost everybody can afford them, but I don't remember anybody talking about bananas with such a passion than you listen people that grew up with mangoes.
Is there a competition between Latin American countries? Do you have an opinion on where the best mango is from?
No, you know, the good thing also is that instead of doing a competition, you share. So you want the other people to know and understand your mangoes. If you talk with somebody from Haiti, they start talking about Madame Francis. I have a neighbor from Jamaica and they have Julie mango in their backyard. And instead of start competing with me, they gave me mangoes every season so I can experience their mangoes and we share.
Right, right. And I want to talk a little later more about that sharing experience that mangoes have, especially here in South Florida. But first, we're not in mango season right now. It's mango blossom season, right? What's the difference?
We are in mango season right now because if we don't take care of our mangoes right now, the flowers, we won't have any mangoes during the summer. So we are in mango season right now. And particularly this year had been amazing with flowers. Probably people that suffer from allergies are complaining about it. I never seen such a blossom in my 20 years in Florida like this year. And we are expecting if everything goes well, we are going to have mangoes everywhere in Miami.
Right. So right now, if I see a mango tree, there's the fruit isn't there, but the flowers are there. And does that give us an indication of how the fruit is going to be once that bloom happens?
The reason because our mangoes are blooming so well is because of the weather. This year, we have cold weather combined with very dry conditions. So we didn't have much rain really during during these 2 weeks and the mango had been blooming. So that means that the flowers are very healthy. Normally in Miami, we have almost everybody is a mango collector and a mango lover and aficionado. So you can see all this diversity of mangoes in every backyard. You know, I consider myself like a fruit hunter in a way, like a mango hunter. And it's just a pleasure to go and see what is available in our neighborhood. There are mangoes of all different kinds. You see the very traditional mangoes that probably start getting planted in Florida, in Miami, is Hayden. Those huge trees that you see in almost everywhere. Those mangoes were planted since the beginning of the beginning of the city. And those mangoes are great, but they are very sensitive to anthracnose. They have these black spots. The tree grows so vigorous that it's difficult to control the size and to get the fruit also. It's very dangerous. So now we have all different kind of mangoes that are dwarfed. Those mangoes are proper for our heavy winds during hurricane season. So it makes a huge difference to have all these mangoes that are available now in our community. And don't forget about Hayden, because it's the grandpa of our mangoes. It's our heritage. But there are different options now that you can have a pleasant experience in a very short time, because, you know, mangoes, they can start producing fruit by the year 3 or 4, depending on the cultivar.
I'm speaking with Dr. Noris Ledesma. She's the president of the Florida State Horticultural Society. We're talking about mangoes. South Florida's streak of cold weather is making this season one of the best in a long time. You can find more information about this mango season and how you can make the best of it on our social media at WLRN Sundial. And for those who have mango trees in their home, in their backyard, what can they do to make the best out of the season?
First of all, the genetics are important. So if you have the right mango that are resistant to all these fungus diseases, it's a plus. So there are already mangoes available, like I said before, like Angie, which is a very good mango for our conditions, and it's also an early cultivar. So you can start having mangoes before everybody else. I like that. And I'm sure you like it too. So, right. And the other advantage be able to eat early mangoes is also because you can have the fruit before rainy season. So the mangoes are clean and they don't get all these diseases and black spots. And they come before hurricanes, so you don't have to be worried. Just imagine those heavy winds with those bullets. So they are going to be flying around because of the heavy winds. So having early mango cultivars, it is a good way to do it. Secondly, is you have to start pruning since the beginning. So if you have, when you go to buy a mango at the nursery or anywhere you want to buy your mango tree, make sure it's grafted, because a mango coming from seeds is going to take longer to produce fruit, and it's going to produce fruit that is a surprise baby. You don't want a surprise baby. You want to know what kind of mango is going to be. You don't want to wait 8 years and then get a surprise that it's not the mango that you were expecting. So it is a good idea when you are buying a tree, start with 3 gallon container. Don't try to get a 20, 25 gallon container. And if you compare one large tree planted with an impatient person, and then you take the time and you plant a small tree, 3 gallon container, your tree is going to go faster than your neighbors. So it's just a process. It's a matter of time. Agriculture is amazing. It's beautiful, but you need patience. It is not easy to produce food, and it's a good lesson for anybody that is engaged with gardening to try it and appreciate food and appreciate the effort that the farmer has to do in order to produce our food. It's not easy. You know, one of the things that we are having right now with the crisis of the coronavirus is many people is coming back to the basics, what is important in life, really. And that's food, shelter, of course, family, all these values that we go so fast sometimes. And then things that happen make you think about the really important things. And I've seen a movement during the past year, and because people cannot go out and do the things that they used to do, they have to do things in their house. So gardening has been one of their escapes. And I think it's the best. They don't have to pay for it, a membership or anything. They are exercising, they are learning. It's like the psychologist as well, because you know, working with plants, it has a plus with nature in general. So you relax, you are in contact with nature, so you just relax. So these kind of things are happening right now. Nurseries sold out mango trees, for instance, by now. Very difficult to get mango trees. It's because of that, all this demand during this difficult year that we're having through.
Right. People being at home, and I mean, if you have soil, you might as well do something with it. And so lastly, with this season coming up being such a good season, I mean, we always have so many mangoes. And like you said, we're sharing them with our neighbors, with our coworkers. It was just mangoes everywhere. What ideas or recipes, what do you do with so many mangoes? How do you keep it still interesting?
You know, mangoes, you can use it in so many different ways. I like to bring the knowledge from India. If you want to learn and experience more about mangoes in one of your trips when we can travel safely, go to India during mango season and experience how many different dishes they do. So when mango season came and it was no way to refrigerate the mangoes, they store mangoes in different ways. And all this knowledge had been passing by through generations. One that is today universal is our chutneys. Chutneys is a way to preserve mangoes, and is so simple and basic. It's salt, sugar, vinegar, and spices. So nothing grow there with those the right proportions of that. So no bacteria or fungus are going to grow. Take some classes about canning and processing, and you can store mangoes in so many different ways, and one is chutney, the other ones are jellies. You can be very creative with all these different canning processing of mangoes. But freezing, you know, you can peel it, cut it in a slice, and put it in a Ziploc and freeze mangoes. I have two coolers in my garage right now, and I store all the mangoes for the whole year, and I have fresh. In my way, it's fresh because I'm not going to buy mangoes at the store. I like my mangoes, and I know how I grew it. And I know that they have no heavy chemicals that are going to harm my body. So I store my mangoes, and I have fruit for all year, and I use it for recipes, for bakery. The other thing that you can do is you dry mangoes. You buy one of these dehydrators, and you can dry your mangoes. The best snack ever. You know, my mom can sit with 1 pound of dry mango to watch her favorite soap opera and end it in no time. It's just so addictive, and it's so healthy as well.
That was Dr. Noris Ledsema. She is the president of the Florida State Horticultural Society. She was speaking with Sundial producer Leslie Ovalle. And you can find more information about this mango season and how you can make the best of it on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Don't know why. Every time I hear about mangoes, I'm now in the mood for a mango. We did hear from some of our listeners, by the way, on our text club. Cassandra said her favorite way to enjoy a mango is fresh, straight from the tree. Karen says, as a native from Jamaica, we have so many varieties, but I will take a semi-green mango with a little salt or a ripe and juicy mango with brown sugar sprinkles. Yum. Yes, that does sound yummy. Logan likes it in a smoothie. just mango and ice. Hey, can't lose that way either. Remember, join our text club. Just text us the word hello to 786-677-0767. Well, that's our program for this Monday, March 29th. Coming up tomorrow on the show, Governor Ron DeSantis has said contact tracing doesn't work, but his administration has already paid $4 million and continuing to pay a hefty sum to a contact tracing app developer. We'll find out why. Plus, the Miami Open is underway. We're going to talk with the tour supervisor about how things are different this time around and how they're trying to keep the players and the fans safe. And finally,
that voice, you know, that baritone, bass, whatever voice, beautiful, so deep. You couldn't be, you were held captive by it. The mustache, you know, the thick mustache.
Former football coach Howard Schnellenberger has passed away. He put the University of Miami football program on the map. Tomorrow, we'll remember some of the great things that he did here in South Florida. I'm Luis Hernandez. As always, thanks so much for listening. The program is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute. Stay safe. Be good to each other. We'll talk to you live tomorrow.